This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
If you're having an experience, then there must be an experiencing of it. Mustn't there be? It's a multi-sensory experience. This experience includes sights and crunchy sounds. Sweet smells and sweet tastes. And that feeling of a body on a cushion and a tongue on a cookie. Maybe even some thoughts. It's a multi-sensory experience. We could even talk about it like there's many experiences going on, but really, it's like there's many aspects. It's a very diverse kind of experience, multi-aspect experience we're having. But the experiencing of all of that, I would propose there's only one experiencing simultaneously seeing and hearing and tasting. And the Buddhist model, sometimes talk about these, like this morning we were talking about the five sense consciousnesses, like those are dualistic consciousnesses, right, that know objects. Those are kind of separate. They're happening individually. And they, in this model, they arise and cease dependent on the objects. Like there was a taste consciousness that arose dependent on this object of an orange, and now that taste consciousness is gone. It arose and ceased. Dualistic consciousness is impermanent, arising and ceasing, and it's dependent on objects. But the experiencing in the background, like the movie screen, see in your own experience if that seems to be arising and ceasing. Or is that more like it's just one experiencing upon which all these multi-sensory events are taking place? Like one screen on which there's different characters walking around, looking at things and hearing things and tasting things. See, it feels to me like there's one experiencing that's actually not really changing, as the experiences seem to change. Do you feel a sense of how that is so? Sometimes, like in the Buddha, especially the early Buddhist teachings, they don't talk that way. They say there's no continuity. There's just this arising and ceasing consciousnesses. So that's one way of talking about it. But this in the later Mahayana teachings, sometimes they start talking like this, that there's an unchanging, non-existent, but not unexistent awareness, always present. To me, that model kind of rings more true to my own experience. It feels as if there's an awareness that's seems to be like the same as this morning's. The experience is all different now. It's a different experience, but the experiencing, just that pure knowing, right, that just ordinary awareness, seems to be pretty much the same. And if we seem to find differences, no, it feels a little bit more cooler or clearer or brighter this afternoon. I would say those qualities we're talking about are the experiences, and they are changing. Anything that we can name as a kind of event that's different than it used to be, that's what we're calling experience. But the experiencing, again, it's not something, it's just... It's just aware in an undifferentiated, unchanging kind of way. You can say it's the same awareness of the taste of tea and the sound of the birds. The experiences are different, but the experiencing is, it can take these different forms. Like hearing and seeing are two different types of experiencing, but they're both experiencing. Is anyone this afternoon not having an experience of some kind? Everyone's having an experience. I figured so. I mean, I don't know for sure because I'm not you, but if you're a person like me, I strongly assume that you're having an experience, and therefore, is there an experiencing of that, of this experience? If you feel like, well, I don't know if I can go that far. See, there must be. It's just that if we feel like we can say there's an experience happening, but I don't know about the experiencing. If we just stop and examine that, we must conclude that if there's an experience, there must be an experiencing of it. They go together. You can't have an experience without experiencing of it. It's just that the experience we can talk about and grasp. Our mind can get a hold of it as a particular event, whereas experiencing, it just slips through our mind's fingers if we try to get a hold of it. So that's where we left off this morning, is awareness present, or is there experiencing? And what is it that knows that there's experiencing? What is it that can answer yes? And I propose that it is just the being aware that is aware of being aware. It is the experiencing that is experiencing. It is knowing that knows that there is knowing. So we can call this self-knowing awareness is one of the terms it's called. It knows itself. Awareness knows itself. It's a self-knowing awareness. All the time it is. It's one of these old Buddhist models. There's awareness of experiences and events, and at the same time, there's an awareness of the awareness of those events, kind of in the background. Anyone not with this description at this point? Yes?
So I find when I sort of turn my awareness onto itself, I can't find an object.
That's right.
You feel like there's nothing there.
We talked a little bit this morning about to say nothing, like there's nothing existent there at all. In a way, it's right to say there's no thing there. You can't find anything. But to say there's nothing at all in the sense of like there's complete blackness or something like that, or there's zero, like it's just pure non-existence, doesn't that feel like it's going too far the other way? Because there's this, all of this.
It's like there's no separate thing.
There's no separate thing, yeah, that's right. There's no separate thing. So here's another interesting, sounds paradoxical, but doesn't this seem true in just our ordinary experience? That, like you say, we cannot find awareness, but also we can't lose awareness. It's never not here. We seem to sometimes, we lose touch with it when we get involved in the experiences of the objects. We forget about the screen, right, when we're watching the movie. But when we're watching the movie, we actually never really lose the screen. It never disappears, right? It's just we're not paying attention to it. They're right there together, right? The experiencing, like the screen, and the experience, like the movie, are there right together. But usually we're much more interested in experiences because they're happening. Whereas the screen isn't really happening. It's not an event. It's always present, but not as something. So that's right. We can't find it, but we can't lose it. Do you see how that, on the surface, it sounds it's like crazy Zen talk or something? But doesn't it seem so in our just ordinary experience? There's this experiencing that we can't find, but this experiencing, we can't lose it either. It can't go anywhere. If it were to go, we would be like dead, right? We would be unconscious anyway. Yeah? So, yes?
Okay, I don't want to distract. I think we've got a lot to cover here, but I was thinking, if the screen is what we think is happening, is that a fair thing? That's what's going on?
The movie is what
The movie is, right.
Mm-hmm. The movie's what's going on.
Okay, right. Movie's what's going on the screen. So I was thinking there's two feeds to this screen. There's the live feed and then there's the DVR feed. And sometimes we confuse the two. And I think the live feed is sort of like the... We know that that's alive and we feel good about that. And that we can tell that's coming. That's like full of awareness and we really feel good about that. But sometimes we get tricked in thinking the DVR feed is true.
Can you help clarify these terms? Is this computer
talk? DVR is like a recorded movie, you know?
Oh, okay.
So, but
what's the live feed?
Live feed is like our...
Video camera? Okay.
Just, you know, yeah, I don't know. What's happening? What's really happening, let's say?
Live cam.
I'm trying to take the movie thing to another... Going with that metaphor.
Well, it sounds like pre-recorded versus live.
That's good.
Okay.
Right. And those two things, you mentioned like you dream, A lot of times those things get a little tangled up in dreams, mm-hmm. particularly. But I think they also, our experience of our lives are like that.
Yeah.
And we go to, I know I come here, help myself disentangle those two feeds.
Well, so when I hear about, when I think of those feeds, and again, we're just playing with metaphors here, I think of like the pre-recorded feed would be like so-called, in this essay, like the past mind, like thoughts that already have, you know, stuff that already happened that we're replaying. That's whereas true. The present feed would be like the present mind.
Yeah, but it seems real. I mean, we can't like, I think that's the, and then, but when we look at it, when we turn the light around, when we look at our awareness, I think we know which one's more, I think it's like a skill to know which one's more real. Like, you know what, that's like, that doesn't feel real to me. That sounds like, that feels like a memory. That does feel real. I think there's a little bit of a, at least this is how this is something that happens for me. But so, I don't know what my point is. It's just that, that's another model, I guess.
If we're talking about past and future, which is where how I interpret what you're talking about, then I agree that past mind and future mind, which would be like creating a fantasy about something that's going to happen in the future and imagining visually.
What's going on right now? I think what people like, we easily read into what's happening to what's happened in the past. I think people are conditioned to do that. So I'm talking about the movie on the movie screen and our feeling, that's our life, let's say. That's our experience of our life. And I think more I that movie screen is filled with the live feed rather than the pre-recorded version or pre-recorded interpretation of what's happening. I have more joy in my life.
In the present mind than the past mind.
All this mind. Is about present. I'm talking all of it's present. It's just how we experience what's happening. The experience you're talking about experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about experiencing too. But I think. That when you say experience, which is an object, which is the past.
No, I'm not talking.
But somehow that gets into the experiencing part. You know that juts in there. And we say, oh, I'm experiencing my mom, but that's not really your mom.
Yeah, I think this is about past and present, and I think it's interesting that the sutra and the essay talks about past, present, and future mind. So I think the present is like the sense consciousnesses, as we talked about this morning, are always about the present. In a way, kind of undiluted present, like we see a color which is not really determined by the past, I would say. The five sense consciousnesses, but the mental consciousness is a lot about the present sensory experience and presently arising thoughts mixed in, like you say, with or kind of tainted maybe, or distorted by past thoughts mixed in. Mental consciousness is definitely like that, and that includes dream consciousness is mental consciousness and churning up images based on past experiences. So, I think, so what we're talking about this morning, listening to the sound of the turkeys versus thinking about whether we made good brownies this morning or not, I think it's much more helpful to listen to the sound of the turkeys in the present, the sensory experience, and because I think in a way you could say all, past, future, and present are all equally types of movies that play on this screen, but the present one is the screen is really so it's so more available to settle into. It's easier to find it. The listening to the turkeys, it's just a slight shift from the sound of the turkeys to the knowing of that sound. Whereas if we're really caught up in the past, whether we made the brownies well or not, or if we're going to make them well in the future, then it's just so much more complicated that we, the screens, it's happening on the same screen of awareness, but it's so much harder to find it.
But even more simply, you can hear the turkeys and you might be an idea of the turkey rather than the turkey. You know, you like, I've heard those turkeys before. I don't need to listen to them anymore. You know, that kind of.
Yeah.
We
add in the conceptual consciousness to the sensory experience. But here the main emphasis I'm making is like putting it. This is a discussion about different types of experience: conceptual versus non-conceptual, memory versus present. And I think that is valid to make these distinctions. But here, when we're looking at the experiencing, emphasizing that the unchanging quality of it, whether it's a horror movie or a love story on the screen, the screen is exactly the same. This is what we're looking at now. It's valid to try to shift horror movies into love stories, but here we're not so much concerned with that. In this discussion, I would say, here we're just looking. Let's really get in touch with this thing that is very hard to remember to attend to, because we're actually, most of the time, we're actually trying to change horror stories into love stories, and therefore we forget the screen that they're both playing on. So once we're somewhat in touch with the screen, we're the conceptual mind is synced into the screen, both S-Y-N synced and S-I-N synced, sunk. We can sync the experience into the knowing of it. Then we can start to explore as the awareness. It's more like now I am this awareness. This is my true being. So without it being theoretical, kind of outside looking in, more as the awareness myself, then we can start to explore myself as the awareness. And so I'll maybe briefly just mention some of this exploration, but the key thing is to first do the steps of is awareness present and really like sink into it, feel some sense of like, there is an awareness here, I can't get a hold of it, but this is it. And then as much as we can be this awareness, then we can start to ask further questions. This is now the kind of Vipassana kind of inquiry. And I think some key questions are like, does this awareness seem to arise and cease? We kind of just talked about that a little. Or can we find like a moment where awareness arises or comes into being or begins? Or can we find a time where awareness seems to cease or disappear and then come back again? We can examine this as the awareness. And we might feel like when we're kind of watching the movie, right, and then we ask the question, is awareness present? And we suddenly shift to like, oh yeah, there's a screen there behind the movie. We might feel like the screen just arose. It just came into existence. We might feel that because I didn't see it at all before. And now suddenly, it's not exactly that I see it, but I'm in touch with it now, and it's undeniable, and it wasn't a minute ago. So we can ask, did it just arise? We can examine this in meditation and see for yourself. To me, it seems like my sense, this is all experiential investigation, my sense is it didn't just arise. It was always there, but I suddenly started paying attention to it. I was completely ignoring it a minute ago. We usually do when we're watching the movie. We usually completely ignore the screen. So that, but if somebody says, is there a screen there? We're like, oh yeah, there is. But did it suddenly arise when you asked the question? No. It was already there, wasn't it? So this is, we can explore. Does awareness arise? And likewise, going along with it, does it cease? And we're talking about kind of flow of time here, these ideas of arising and ceasing. Sometimes in Buddhism, they talk about experiences arise, and then they abide for a moment, and then they cease. Experiences are like that. They do arise. Don't they seem to... The movie character walks onto the screen. He wasn't there before, or he was lying down and arose and stood up. That's what we call arising, but that's the move. In the movie, there's arising and ceasing. The movie's total impermanence. But is the screen arise? And does the screen abide? We might feel like, yeah, the screen's abiding. But again, it's like this question of, does it exist? Not really. So I would say you could explore this. Is there some abiding quality of awareness, or is it not? Is that too coarse a way of talking about this awareness? It doesn't really abide. It doesn't really arise. It doesn't really abide, and it doesn't really cease. It doesn't fit into these categories because it's not an experience. All experiences do fit into those categories. So this is one line of inquiry regarding kind of like, is this awareness happen in time? And if it doesn't arise, abide, or cease, it's timeless. Right. Yes?
You bring up time now, and that's what I've been thinking about, how the Christian mystics talked about time in two ways, as fluens and span. Fluens was like a second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, kind of a linear progression of experiences.
Okay.
Stands was the eternal
nice
moment,
yeah,
in which eternity exists.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't any past or present.
Mm-hmm.
It's always now.
Nice.
And but that was, you know,
that's what we're talking about, yeah. Fluens and stands, yeah.
Fluens and stands,
yeah.
But the thing is,
the eternal now.
I've always thought the witness was the term for that, which where we say, oh, I was watching, you know, like you said, there's kind of an object.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the witness was the last level, but what you're saying is there's a level beyond what we consider to call the witness of things that's just consisting of this kind of universal presence.
I like the word universal presence, and the word witness, some people use that for this awareness we're talking about, and it has some validity. It's like there's a witnessing presence of awareness that's not changing as the experiences, as the witnessed change. But I don't like to use the word witness so much because, again, these are all words, and we're just trying to choose accurate ones, but the problem with the word witness is it, again, usually implies that there's something that's witnessed. It's usually there's some duality involved. I'm witnessing something. So if we don't think of it that way, then I think we could use like witness for non-dual awareness. But when trying to choose the best words, I think that's the potential problem with the word witnessing. Again, at first, when we're first discovering it, like you say, there's maybe another layer. Maybe at first, is awareness present? What we say yes, but what we actually discover is dualistic consciousness. It's not non-dual awareness. We might say what we first discover is the witness of all experiences. But then that's still, how are we gonna dissolve this illusion of duality? So, but I like that... The flow of time and then the eternal now that's unchanging. It's the same now. Can I say, like, all Buddhas realize unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment now. In this now that we're in now. The Shakyamuni Buddha, we say he lived 2,500 years ago, but from this stands point of view, he lived now. He lives now. But the experience of like that body and mind stuff, that's gone. But you could say the experiencing you could even say Buddha's experiencing is this experiencing that we're in now. This is now we're getting into. Are there, if there's 7 billion people in the world, are there 7 billion experiencings? I'd say there's 7 billion experiences, but the experiencing of them, we can't find any differentiation. So it's kind of like it's the same experience. It's almost like it's another word for the now. I think we can say this another name for this awareness. It sounds very different. We could call it presence or now. But it has this kind of, as a sentient being, it has this kind of cognizing aspect. So another way to talk about this, fluence and stands, was it?
Fluence,
which is like flowing, right? Yeah. Fluence and stands. Yeah, it's like the mirror is like stands, unchanging mirror, or the screen we're talking about. You could say mirror too. The TV screen is like the stands, and the movies like the fluence. So what we call time is in the category of the movie. Time is like is an experience. That might be sound like a radical statement. Time is not something that we are flowing through. Time is like an experience flowing through us as awareness, as unchanging awareness. So that's the time dimension. Then I just mentioned the space dimension. So again, this how you can investigate it in Zazen is first really have to establish yourself as the presence of awareness to do this. And then we can ask, is this awareness, this one right now, not theoretically, this one, look for, does it seem to be arising and ceasing? That's how we can establish its timelessness. Then in terms of space, we can now ask, does this awareness seem to have a center, or does it seem to have edges or boundaries? And again, in our own experience, looking for it, we might feel, I think a lot of people feel like, I don't know about boundaries, I can't find where it ends, but it seems to be centered in my body or my head. So this is it's a little harder to find the centerlessness. But I think that if we feel like, yeah, there really is a center of my awareness, it's behind my eyeballs and behind my ears. I think that's why we think it's located here, because our sense organs are here. It's not about the brain, I don't think that we feel that. Maybe that helps solidify this illusion. But I think it's because we seem to be looking out from the source of awareness seems to be located behind the eyeballs and behind the ears, nose, and tongue, which coincidentally all seem to be located in a similar location. So we might feel like, I really feel like awareness has this center here. But so then we have to kind of dismantle this illusion, because it's not really there. Is we have to say, That sense of the center of awareness being located in the head, that sense of location, I would call an experience. That's the key. This is the pivotal thing, right? It's a subtle experience that we're starting to interpret as experiencing itself. But it's an experience. Anything is an experience if we can say, well, is there an experiencing of that? So if we have it's a sense of location in the head, we say, well, what is experiencing that sense of location in the head? And we found it again. We found the unlocated awareness. This is a little tricky, right? But can you follow? I feel the sense of location in my head. Well, what is it that knows this sense of location? Awareness knows it. Now, does this knowing of the sense of location have a location? There. there we find the unlocatedness of awareness. And likewise with edges or outer boundaries. If we feel like my awareness reaches to the edge of this room and then it doesn't go beyond, so it actually has a bound, it has an edge at the edge of the room or something like this. My seeing has a boundary, but that's the edge of the room is an experience. Does the experiencing of the edge of the room have a boundary? If the whole thing starts to fall apart, and almost like the questions don't make sense. Does experiencing have a center or boundary? And it helps us get in touch with what awareness is too when we start asking this, because it's again very strange. It has no boundaries or edges. And because also we could say boundaries, edges, and center and location are physical, the qualities of physical space. Awareness is not physical space. Therefore, how could it have centers and boundaries? But we explore this deeply in our meditation, and it's very spacious. We can start to see there. It starts to become almost like nothing again. There's no center or edges, and we start to say, well, then there's nothing. It's just like it's like empty space, which is often what the Zen people, the image they use to talk about this is like it's like space, but it's not physical space. Exactly. Physical space comes very close. I think one of the best metaphors, because space has no center or edges, right? But this is like the space of awareness is not a physical space. It's I don't know what it is. And yet, doesn't seem that in addition to having no temporal dimension of time, it doesn't seem to arise and cease or abide. And it also, spatially, it doesn't seem to have any center, location, or edges. Again, we talked about how the movie is like time is like a movie playing on the screen of the eternal now. Space, what we call physical space, like measurable space, is also like an aspect of the movie playing on the screen of awareness. So time and space, from this perspective, are like a movie. They're just the play of this screen that's timeless and spaceless and dimensionless. Again, so strange, right? Then we might say, well, if it's timeless and spaceless, then it's just nothing. We start to, and it's very close to nothing, right? It's not a thing, but yet, this is it, right? It's like, it's not nothing. We're aware, and it's very ordinary. It's not something special. It's just our own ordinary mind, where we start to examine it, is huge. Suzuki Roshi calls big mind. It's a little bit off, right? Because it's not really huge. Huge is a size, but it's not small. It's actually dimensionless. We have this jewel mirror samadhi chant we do where we say, so vast it transcends dimension, so small it fits into spacelessness. Just talking about this.
In Buddhist sutras, I've heard the word the source shines clear in the darkness.
Yeah.
Is this the same?
We can call it that. We can call it many things, yeah. The source of all things. And I think that fits with the movie screen metaphor, right? We could say the source of the movie on the TV is the screen. It's arising from the screen. We could talk about it in different ways too, but that's why it's nice to talk about TV instead of big screen movies. Because big screen movies, there's a projector outside it, but from a TV or computer screen, it's like the screen itself gives rise to the movie. It's the source of the movie. The source is not somewhere other than the movie. But you could say it's kind of like behind it. Or it's the Another nice word the Zen people use is host. Host and guest. Like this awareness is the host of all experiences. Experiencing is the host of all experiences, which are like guests that come and go, but the host never leaves. Yes.
In exploring consciousness, our eyes are directly connected to our brains, and my eye consciousness is here. I can tell my nose consciousness is here, but as my awareness is perceiving the location of where these consciousnesses are, and then there's also the mind consciousness, which I too have felt somewhere. But like you said, there's an awareness outside. There's something aware of where that is and where.
Exactly. And that awareness of where that is doesn't seem to be anywhere, does it?
So that's where all dimension and time disappear.
Yeah. And this is it. You make a nice point that, which is why this morning we talked about distinguishing consciousness, which is these sense consciousnesses, and it's always dualistic by its very nature. It's always knowing an object. It's a subject knowing an object. So the sense consciousnesses have objects like colors and sounds, but they also have subjects like eyes and ears. And all those are located, right? The eyes and ears are located, and the colors and the sounds are located. So that's why that whole thing is kind of restricted. All the consciousnesses have a subject and an object, so there's a duality between them. And therefore, as I mentioned this morning, there's always grasping. As soon as you have a split into a subject and object, there's always one part of it grasping another part of it. And also there's a sense of location. But this awareness of that whole process is there's no grasp, there's nothing to grasp. Mind cannot be grasped, as this essay says, big mind, because there's nothing outside of itself, actually. It has no objects. So part of this exploration of are there any edges or boundaries of this awareness? If we can come to see that I can't find any, we might say, well, maybe there are, but I can't find any. Well, we shouldn't assume that there are if we can't find them. Let's stay with our experience. I can't find any edges. And if I found an edge, it would be an experience. And we could again ask, what is it that knows this edge, this experience of an edge or a boundary? And that knowing.
Is experiencing the grasping then? Is that like...
could say grasping is when experiencing, we're using again for this the vast undifferentiated field, right? When that manifests, when that boundless awareness expresses itself as dualistic consciousness, it contracts, it takes the form of dualistic consciousness, of boundless awareness, manifests as dualistic consciousness. That's when the grasping happens. So we could say that the true nature of dualistic consciousness is nothing other than non-dual awareness. And actually the true nature of grasping, even, the true nature of any possible experience, its true nature is just the knowing of it. The true nature of anything that happens in a movie, there's, you know, a movie character in this movie is like picking up some object and holding it tightly. You could say that's a movie of grasping, but the true nature of that grasping is the screen on which it's appearing. Does that make sense? So there's nothing accepted. There's no exceptions to to the true nature of things being this empty awareness, including grasping.
So the grasping is a kind of, just another kind of experience.
Yes.
Experiencing can experience.
That's right, exactly. Exactly. But it's like, it's one of the real key experiences in Dharma practice that we're, it's basically grasping, which you're talking about the mind grasping an object of mind, which could be like a physical thing, or a sound, or a smell, or a taste, or a physical sensation, or a thought, or an emotion, any experience. And interestingly, the Buddha's definition of suffering in like the Four Noble Truths, it's not so much that it's the cause of suffering, it's the definition of suffering is grasping. So it's a key point. You might say, just grasp. If we really examine our experience, what is when I'm suffering, I really feel discontent. What is that? If we examine it kind of psychologically, like go right to the kind of root of it, it's grasping. It's grasping an object. Always, check it out for yourself. Even if you say it's physical pain, you could say it's like, we could have some physical pain without it necessarily being discontent with that. That's almost like, it's just an experience happening, we're really seeing it that way. It could be that there's no wanting to get rid of it. So then we just say it's not necessarily suffering in that Buddhist sense. But if there's any trying to like change it, it's almost like we've grasped it as it's something that exists and I want to either get more of it or want to get rid of it or change it or fix it or keep it or something. And that's when we're basically lost in the movie. We've totally forgotten the screen.
It seems to me that like mental grasp, that grasping for me is like always mental though, right? Like mentally grasping onto different modalities versus like modalities grasping. Is that
mental as opposed to like physical?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like true.
It happens through through language.
Yeah, I mean we could say like you know, right now I'm like physically grasping this thing, right? And really tightly. And it's like, it's starting to get a little bit physically uncomfortable. But it's not necessarily discontent or suffering. If I do this long enough, then my mind, you're right, my mind will start to say, this is getting really uncomfortable. Like, and in fact, my whole body is starting to tense up because my hands are holding so tight. And like, and I'm, therefore my mind's getting more agitated. But I think it's true from a Buddhist perspective, we're mostly talking about the mind's grasping. But it's often connected with physical. They go together, right? So that's why in Zazen, if we relax the body and the breath, these physical experiences, it actually starts, it affects the mind too. The mind will start releasing its grasp. And likewise, like I mentioned this morning, I feel like when I start exploring, is awareness present? And kind of like the screen starts to become more apparent. The body, which is part of the movie, right? The body starts to relax. It's like the screen starts to affect the movie. Body and mind. Because the screen and the movie are like, there's no separation between them, really.
So are you using just basic multiple definitions of grasping or multiple gradations of grasping? Because when you're greedy and you grasp, there's ego in it.
Yes, yeah.
When you're grasping an idea, it's like, got it. Well, that's not something like...
So painful. It's not so painful.
It's not painful. Mm-hmm. It's like what we do.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. No, you're exactly right. Different gradations.
This kind of grasping, to grasp the ungraspable mind, it's essential.
Well, to grasp it, to understand it. In a way, what we're doing here, it's true. What we're doing in this discussion is grasping. Yeah, we're grasping ideas. We're using words. So it's kind of rough, but we're having this discussion so that we can you know, get more and more into the actual direct experience possible to have, like, non-grasping, just being that screen. But you're right, right now I'm grasping words to express things. And there's these gradations, and this morning Andy said, like, I was surprised to hear that sense consciousnesses are grasping. Just direct sense perception is a kind of grasping. So that's like one end of the gradation, one end of the spectrum, very subtle grasping, because there's no conceptuality, just an eye knowing a color. But we wouldn't use that term upadana, the Sanskrit term for grasping there, but it's like, how does the Buddha put it? It's like, he uses some other term that means something like sense perception is like getting a hold of an object. It's a kind, in that way, it's a kind of grasping. And we might say, in the early Buddhist teachings, they don't emphasize this kind of subtlety, this end of the gradation so much. They more talk about grosser grasping, which is good. So excuse me for getting so subtle like that. I love the subtlety. But in the early teachings, we might say, well, can't you have sense perception without grasping? And I would say a clue to the fact that even in these early teachings, the Buddha is saying maybe not, is the 12-fold chain of causation, where we say, when we're talking about, I don't want to get too into all this Buddhist technical stuff, but we say with the arising of the six senses, there's the arising of contact between the sense and the color, and with the arising of contact, there's the arising of feeling of pleasant or unpleasant, and then depending on that, there's craving and then grasping. And then there's this reversal part for the kind of nirvanic realization where the 12-fold chain goes in reverse with the cessation of the six senses. So I think that's a clue that, like, for Buddhas, he doesn't say this so outright. It's all a little bit, all these teachings are a little bit cryptic because it's hard to talk about. But it seems to me like when we say this, the Buddha's kind of saying for this complete liberation, there's this ceasing of the six senses. There aren't, like, Buddhas don't have sense consciousnesses anymore. It's kind of implied in this 12-fold chain. And then the later Yogacara tradition in the Mahayana makes it more explicit and actually says for Buddhas, the five consciousnesses are transformed into non-dual awarenesses. So it's really saying that Buddhas really don't have sense consciousnesses, but they have non-dual awarenesses, which I understand to mean, like, there can be a seeing, what we would call seeing a color. The Buddhas, looks to us like they have eyes and ears, and we can talk to them, and they can respond. We say, isn't that sense consciousness? No, because they don't see that the color is separate from the perceiver. It's like one unified whole. So it's not called consciousness anymore. It's called awareness. It's not called vijnana. It's called jnana.
And clear seeing? Is that I saw that somewhere in Yogacara, or valid cognition sometimes too. Like, it's just recognizing it as a play of awareness? Or
valid cognition, like that, you know, pramana, this kind of valid cognition is another topic in a way. And they're talking about, there's direct valid cognition, we're talking about the senses, and that is still dualistic consciousness. But then there's different types of, this is actually where, I don't want to get too sidetracked, but this is where this self-aware, talking about awareness is aware of itself. One of the valid cognitions in this pramana tradition of Yogacara is that it's called self-aware direct valid cognition, and it's saying that's one of the ways that creeps into this. Its non-duality creeps into the system. There's an aspect of awareness that's always aware of itself, and it's a valid cognition. But sense consciousnesses they're direct because they're not conceptual, but they're still, you could say, slightly dualistic. But then there's yogic direct valid cognition, and that would be, you could say, like the realization of non-duality through vipassana. So.
So is it fair to think of it more like expansion of a inclusiveness? So like,
yeah,
there's a narrowness in the way that we experience the world, and as you get kind of backwards, or you step back to see this experiencing, that gets included. So it's not to say that your experiences are no longer valid or they disappear or anything, they're still there, right? So hence that there is still this Buddha consciousness, kind of, they can interact with you in the way that you interact with them, but they're seeing it from a much more inclusive point of view.
Yes.
Right? And so therefore, we're grasping here, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't. Right, like, or like, you know, like, otherwise, right, like, we're here doing something. We're using the experiences in some ways.
Yeah, we're using them hopefully in a good way in this
right.
kind of discussion.
And with, I don't know, with the.
I think the key point that you said is a great point, is this about inclusive, because that's another way of talking about, if awareness has no boundaries or edges, another way of saying that is, it is all inclusive. It include if we can't find any edges or boundaries, then there, another way of saying that is, there can't be anything outside of it. Just like we talked about, like space, vast space of the universe. If it has no edges, there's nothing outside of it. In the space of awareness, if it has no edges, there's nothing outside. Everything, meaning every experience, is now within it, included within it. Yes, exactly. These are all ways of just talking about this experience, but it's a really good one. And that's exactly right. Then if we really understand that the experience of even a color is not now outside, it's not like awareness is going out and meeting the color. The color is arising within awareness. Then you could see, we could still talk about seeing a color, but it's not grasping. There could be the non-grasping of it, because it's the play, or like this expression, or this manifestation of awareness as color. Yes?
I'm having a lot of trouble with this. I keep going back to just the physical understanding. A color, or let's say the floor, or whatever, or a flower, what I conceptualize as color is the wavelength of light that hit my retina that I can physically perceive. If you're a bee looking at the same external object, that bee is going to have a different experience of color.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, I can also conceptualize and build an instrument to measure wavelengths of light, including far red and that my eyes can't see, but because I have the mathematics to do it, and the physics, I know that exists, and I also know that the bee is experiencing that flower color differently than I'm experiencing it. So
you're bringing in like physical science now.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's fine to bring it in. And talk about, it's just different models for talking about experiencing, but the basic thing is the same of experiencing. We could say this: all the laws of physics are the laws of the movie in this model, and they're valid.
And the bee's experiencing is different than the human eye's experiencing.
Yeah.
And the human brain can conceptualize wavelength of light, which the bee brain doesn't have the capacity to do it.
So now we're talking about differentiating experiences, which is kind of what Jeff was doing too. And I want to just not get too, I agree with everything you're saying, but I want to not get too caught up in the specifics of the experiences. That's what we're usually doing all day long, is we're into the specifics of experiences. But this model of whatever science we're using, for the bee and for us, the experience, we could talk about it in all different ways, but the experiencing would be the same. Right.
Actually, for me, the physical science really helps me remove those boundaries, because there is this flower. There is this thing that reflects wavelengths of light. It's the fact that the bee and I perceive the color differently, but that I can conceptualize the fact that the wavelength of light exists regardless of the bee and regardless of me. That, for me, removes the boundaries between me, the bee, the flower, and light.
And I like what you said, that you can conceptualize the wavelengths of the light. So it's good to remember that any story we tell about Dharma or science is our conceptualization of its consciousness creating a beautiful stories that makes sense. There's laws. These stories are not random. They're right. They follow laws. But from the point of view of experiencing, all these amazing discoveries of science and Buddhas and all are all experiences happening that is changing our world and changing the way we perceive things. But the key point here is all of that is arising within this timeless, spaceless experiencing. And that we, maybe scientists would talk about that as a quantum field or something, and Buddhists would talk about it as the Dharmakaya. But
see, that's what I think is so amazing about Buddhism, that the more we are understanding now about the physical world, that the insight that human brain had into the nature of reality, to me, makes it even more marvelous.
Yeah. What we're talking about now is discovering, we're talking about like the nature of reality, right?
It's the nature of reality.
The screen, right? And that it's human, it's conceptual human brains are kind of discovering something that we maybe, when we first see it, it seems kind of amazing, but I like how in Zen they also call this screen of reality, they call it ordinary mind. It's awesome. From its perspective, it's not something special. It's just like the way it is. But for us, sentient beings, it's very special. That's what the whole path of practice is about, transforming our suffering, our grasping. This is like, this whole story is just to relieve our suffering. Hopefully we don't lose track of that point. Yes.
It seems to me that, like, the usual presentation about how to direct our effort is to actually direct our effort towards experience, towards things that are experienced, and see how those are arising and ceasing. And
directions, like in Buddhism?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would say Suzuki Roshi's teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even Dogen's teaching, study the self.
Well,
things that are,
depends what you mean by the self. But okay,
yeah.
Keep going.
Yeah. So,
but you're right, there's a lot of Dharma teachings.
We direct our effort to the study of mundane reality.
And yes.
And that's where we start.
Yeah.
And I think maybe what myself, maybe others are hearing from you is, well, that's okay, and that's a good practice. There's this other possibility of studying experience in directly.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I feel like
I would suggest not a mainstream presentation, but
yeah. No, I agree. I agree. So, and I sometimes have mixed feelings because I feel like when I listen to mainstream Dharma, I don't hear this kind of thing so much, or there's like little versions of it, but then they're maybe they've really fallen into the first type of looking at experiences, just more and more refined experiences, and lots of Buddhist teachings like that. And it may be that even the Buddha taught a lot, mostly about experiences. Mostly the Buddha taught about the movie, actually, especially the early teachings. And yeah.
Dharma talk about anger.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Relationships.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. And that's partly why I'm doing this, is because I hear a lot of that. It's being covered. If it wasn't being covered, and but yeah, but sometimes I hesitate because it's kind of subtle, this stuff, and I think if you're newer to practice, it can sound kind of overwhelming. But I also have the trust that it's something quite ordinary, actually. It's if we're willing to really examine our own experience very carefully. It's kind of like in Zen, the sort of sudden school method, which if you read the early Zen stuff, it's pretty radical. And it's a lot about emptiness and no mind, and the way that those Zen people talked, we don't talk anymore because it seems like it's too much. And maybe their context was people who already studied all the aspects of the movie already. But so I don't know. Yeah, as a skillful means, I sometimes have questions. But as you can see, I can't help it talking about this. And for myself, for my own practice, it's totally like the heart of my practice. I trust it so deeply, and therefore I'm trying to share from my own experience too. Yes.
Thank you. I think it's very useful and helpful. And from my experience, when we came here on Friday, I had worked a lot and was really busy, and my mind was wrapped up in that, and I felt tense. And then from being here and doing Zazen and thinking about this, kind of like we're awareness, aware of awareness, and really helps me to relax and just let go of all that other stuff. And I think it really breaks down barriers too, because if you look at any person or being and think that being is just awareness, aware of awareness, the same as me, then it does help you to let go of all the things that you think are different from yourself or separate.
Totally. Yeah, and we say, they are awareness of awareness, the same as me. Again, we might at first say, yeah, they're just this amazing location of as a body and mind that's experiencing. But when we say their true nature of that location of that body and mind is simply the experiencing in which everything's happening, then we say, They're the same as me, not as their mind operates in exactly the same way, but literally, this is part of the questioning we can do too. Literally, they are the same as me, because if there's no boundaries in this awareness, if we can't find any edges, then we can't find a boundary between my awareness and your awareness, right? If we were to find one and say, like, there must be one that makes me and me, well, there's different conceptual consciousnesses with all its own, their memories and thoughts and experiences, but the awareness of that, if we can't find a boundary, then that's like our identity, our true nature. And if we do have some sense of boundary, again, that beautiful question that we can always take a step further back is, what is it that's aware of the boundary between me and you? And we find, and is that awareness, located in me or you? No, it's more like we are located in it. It's another dual mirror samadhi line, right? It's like, you are not it.
Yeah.
It, in truth, is you. It's like, our bodies and minds, our consciousnesses, you could say are manifestations or expressions of this boundless awareness within the boundless awareness. Our true nature is that. Of course, we appear to be separate bodies and consciousnesses, but on the deepest level, same, we're like the same, not similar. Right? And the same as Shakyamuni Buddha, and the same as Hitler, and the same as every possible experience throughout space and time. We are like the universe, actually, right? In our deepest nature.
Thank you.
We are everything. So this is a nice way of talking about it. First, we feel as if I am something. I am a body and a mind having experiences. That's who I am. I'm something. Then we start to explore, like, who I truly am is none of those things. I am more like my true nature. What I mean by I is like the boundless awareness. It's more like, it's not that I'm something, I'm more like nothing. I'm no thing at all. And then as we explore this issue of boundaries and all-inclusiveness, then we go from I am nothing to I am everything. I am something is very limited and inherently painful to be somebody, an individual. I am nothing is quite liberating, but it might feel kind of like cold or lifeless or something. But then I am everything is like...
Or is it everything is me? Because that's different.
I would say that's, again, as Jivamira Samadhi says, you are not it. It is you. It's putting you or it as the center. I here, we don't mean I the person. We mean the I that includes the whole universe, that we all, the I that we all share. So,
I was asking this question. You said yourself that you, when we began, you said something about, like, I don't know for sure because I'm not in your head. Kind of, you said that at the very beginning of this meeting. To somebody, I forgot who it was.
Yeah, we don't share the same consciousness. Yeah. We share the same awareness.
Well, how do you know that? That's the thing. Isn't that a big leap?
You might say it sounds like a huge leap.
It
I agree.
Like a huge leap.
But I'd say the way to explore this, to make it not be a totally random, far-out, New Agey thing, is this Vipassana exercises. Don't forget how we got there. We got there by first, am I aware? Yes, we rest as nature awareness. As this awareness, can I find any edges or boundaries? That's the key point. We might say there might be some, but we have to experientially, not as an idea. Can I find any boundaries? If we don't find any boundaries, now we're approaching a kind of direct experience of our shared unity.
There's an act of faith there, though, right? Because how do you know that's exactly the experience of somebody else?
No, you're falling into experience again.
You're experiencing it with no, or whatever you're talking about, like there's no boundary, right?
You have to confirm that yourself, don't
you? Sure, but
assume,
but,
right?
means you and I won't run into it, or we'll run into each other somehow and come together.
See, what you're doing is you're mixing these two levels. You're mixing the level of experience.
You say so, there's no border. I mean, what's that? That's
there's, the Buddha teaches these two truths, and I think there aren't really two truths, but it's a really important model. In this case, there's the ultimate truth of boundless awareness with no separation. And there's the conventional truth of appearances, of bodies and minds that bump into each other and think different thoughts. And these two truths are inseparable, and yet they're not murkily mixed. They're not, it's a model, a conceptual model of two truths, but it's, I think, very helpful to say our bodies will bump into each other. And what we're calling that's the conventional truth of experiences that are impermanent and bump into each other and experience pain and pleasure. And then there's the experiencing that's not one of those things that bumps into things.
I'm aware of my awareness and I can't find a place for it.
Yes.
Right? And someone else also has that.
I think
that understanding of experiencing.
Yes. Yes.
So therefore.
Yes.
They're the same.
Exactly, because if you.
Hold on.
You know, spend some time with it. Spend some time.
I can have all of my
you just described it very nicely there. No, no.
Realization.
So maybe this is another point that I'll just add in here, but with one last point about this is that when we discover this ourselves as this true awareness, you could say, well, then should we assume that this awareness that we know ourselves to be is the same for everybody? Is that kind of a deduction? I think when we have this sense, part of one of the signs of it is there's a very, very strong sense that this awareness we're experiencing must be the same for all sentient beings. It's not like I would say, you might call that a leap of faith, but is it a very strong sense? Because it's reality, is what I would say. It's like if you start to tap into timeless and spaceless, then you can't say, some people aren't timeless and spaceless. It's like, no, there aren't multiple realities. So, but I know, no, I would say this is one of the, you have to make it a living experience. These are a lot of words, and maybe it's getting too many words, and we should do some more zazen, because we have to directly confirm. Like I said, the other night in Santa Cruz, talking about sometimes there's this model of there's understanding that's conceptual understanding, and that's what we're doing in these talks. And it's conceptual, and it's said to be like, I think it's necessary. We have, because these are subtle points, we have to use words. That's what the Buddhas do anyway. And then we can have a conceptual understanding, but it's like a patch. It will fall off. And then we can bring it into meditation and explore it in direct experience. We can have an experience, but experience like a direct non-conceptual experience of non-duality. We can have that. There can be such an experience. But an experience is like mist. It also fades. We've been talking about experience is something temporary. And then there's realization, which is like when there's continuity of, there's no gaps, and it's not a temporary thing. This is like the Buddhas are never leave the recognition of their true nature.
We're saying our experience is the same as reality. How we're experiencing is equivalent to reality.
Experiencing.
Yeah, I mean that
is another name. These are words, so we don't have to.
It's an interesting assertion, you know, but that's a principle.
We talk this way.
Certainly, we're checking things out for ourselves if it's true for us. But you know, that's like.
I think another way you could say it is if you discover in your own awareness that it has no time or space, and you can directly, not as an idea, but directly confirm that through these investigations, then you don't have to call that reality, but then you can say, now let's see how that kind of sits in our heart, maybe, that experience, and then go back to our usual experience of like, you're over there and I'm over here and we're like separate beings, and then say, which one seems more real? This is the ultimate truth, that we're like these separate beings, and that was just an illusion. Maybe we could, I'm willing to say that, but the feeling is more like, you could say, is it a deluded feeling? You feel like this feels more in accord with truth or reality.
I'm guessing everyone in this room would not dispute that. Everyone feels more real with this practice.
Yeah, like that.
Okay.
That's why we do it, right?
But I think maybe that's enough to push it and say this, these assertions. I feel like it's on the edge. It's pushing.
What's the assertion? To say it's ultimate truth?
Yeah, ultimate, all that stuff. I mean, it's...
Well, that's why even in the tradition, they sometimes say the ultimate truth is that there is no ultimate truth. Maybe that's you. Maybe you'd like
to put it that way.
I'm willing to say that.
Yeah.
There's definitely no graspable ultimate truth.
I'm sort of, it's like maybe we don't know camp, you know, and it gets... it gets sketchy if we start leaping into like we do know.
I know, and a lot of Zen people, I think, do say, people, especially Zen people, like there's a lot of Zen talk about not knowing is most intimate, right? And I think it's a good teaching because, and what I think it's talking about is to conceptually grasp anything. That type of knowing is always painful and deluded. But my understanding of the tradition is saying the Buddha's, they call it like direct knowledge and vision. There's like a, there's, this word jnana is what the Buddha's realization is, a kind of a knowing of, and they use the terms ultimate truth too, paramartha satya is a kind of a jnana, and it's an ultimate knowing. So it's dangerous. I think that's why the Zen people like to bring it down to earth and talk about not knowing because we don't want to grasp. But sometimes we can use it as an excuse to be like, well, I don't want to get a hold of anything here. So what we're really doing is just maintaining our habitual dualistic consciousness, maybe sometimes. So I want to be open to the possibility of the Buddha's, like sometimes in the sequence of practice that they talk about, they practice virtue, and then the Buddha's practice take care of each other, virtue, and then based on that concentration of the mind and based on that wisdom of how things are and based on that liberation from all suffering and based on that, the knowledge and vision of liberation. It's interesting that they like this. Why not just have liberation without knowing what it is? But the Buddhas are like, the Buddhas say like, it is done. What was to be accomplished has been accomplished. The goal has been fulfilled. That's kind of like, you could say it's arrogant, but there's no self, separate self there. But it's a knowing. Some people, maybe it's too much for people.
Just they know something, great. But you can't assume everyone knows the same thing. Or yeah, it's sort of exactly.
Yes.
It occurs to me that this movement between just conceptual, between experience and experiencing.
Yeah.
In a certain sense, it's functioning all the time, and it's just pervasively functioning all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And can't be lost.
It's actually a natural way that we move in the world. Like, I was thinking of the metaphor that, using vision is kind of a metaphor that most of the time we're just focusing. I look at the candle, I look at you, I look at that. I'm with identification,
yeah.
Really following.
Mm-hmm.
But all the time that we're doing that, we're also seeing the whole room, being aware of other people, having that kind of soft focus.
Peripheral.
The whole world.
Mm-hmm.
So at least as a kind of metaphor of how we see,
mm-hmm.
I think we move back and forth between these
experiencing, mm-hmm.
between the screen. I think we know that the screen is screen. We do know that the screen is screen almost continuously. It's almost like we have to survive, has to be some level, some acknowledgement of that.
Could be. It's so hard to talk about knowing the screen because it's not a thing that we perceive like other objects, right?
Maybe more like an assumption.
Yeah, or we're like in touch with it without even knowing that we're in touch with it, for example. Like Dogen talks about how everything's interacting in this amazing way and all the rocks and tiles are conversing with the Buddhas and all this. And he said, all this, however, doesn't appear within our perception, within our dualistic consciousness. It doesn't appear. But we could say, well, how can he say that then? He said, well, this is kind of like this background sense. Or maybe it's just his poetic trust that that's how it actually is. Yeah. Yeah. known?
Not conceptually known, but it seems like it's...
There's a lot that we know that's not conceptual knowing. So we're not making it very far through this essay, are we? Still in the first character. Let's at least finish the title. Shin Fukatoku. So far we've just been talking about shin, mind. Fu means not. Ka means like the ability, having the ability. And then toku means like to grasp. So mind does not have the ability to grasp, would be kind of literal. Mind is not able to grasp, ungraspable mind. Mind cannot be grasped. And this grasp, this toku, is not the character for like upadana grasping, but it's another translation says mind cannot be got. Toku means like acquire, get, gain, receive, or attain. Mind cannot be attained, or gained, or gotten. But grasp is like, makes it very nice and solid. We have this ceremony called Tokudo, like receiving the precepts. Zaike Tokudo and Shuke Tokudo. And it's the same toku. There it's do in this case is it's what they use for paramita, like to cross over, or and also what we use for to save all beings. It's this character do. Sometimes it gets mistranslated as attaining the way, because there's another character do that means way, but it's a false translation that somehow stuck at least in San Francisco Zen Center. But this do is it's really like. Tokudo is like attaining, literally you could say attaining salvation or attaining liberation, maybe we'd say, or attaining crossing over or attaining like that. So here, mind cannot be attained. And Shakyamuni Buddha says, past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, future mind is ungraspable. So hopefully that's clear. Especially past and future mind are really ungraspable because the past mind is gone. It can't be grasped because it's not here at all, right? The future mind hasn't happened yet, so it definitely can't be grasped. It's not here at all. The present mind is where we might think that we could somehow grasp it, but we've come to see that it can't be, right? Both, two, remember, small mind and big mind, small mind of dualistic consciousness and everything in the movie, that aspect of mind, that can't really be grasped either. Because it's just images on the screen. You can't really grasp anything if you start to look at it. Everything that's appearing within the boundless sphere of awareness, you can't really grasp anything because the thing would have to be outside it to grasp it. So each individual experience we can't really grasp, but also big mind itself, the awareness in which they're all appearing, can't be grasped either, because it's not something to grasp.
Does that make them non-existent?
Well, we talked about that this morning, right? We talked about awareness. Is it existent? It seems like it's not really some existent thing, but to say it's non-existent seems to be going too far the other way. Because it's appearing like this. That's what we're talking about, awareness. And then you could say the things, that experiences that are appearing within the awareness, everything of our life, does that exist? We'd say, in a way we could say, it exists, like, does the movie exist? We could say, in a way, the movie exists as the screen. That's its... If it has any existence, its existence is the screen, but we've just come to see that the screen doesn't exist. See, the true nature of the movie is the screen. It's what it's made of. The true nature of all our experiences is made of the knowing of it, made of awareness. But the true nature of awareness is doesn't exist. So the things don't exist, but also they don't not exist, like this piece of paper to say it doesn't exist at all. I mean, it doesn't exist as a separate entity the way we think it does, but it appears to us and we can use it. In that way, we don't negate it completely, like it doesn't, there's nothing here. There's something here, but it's not what we think it is. It's a manifestation of awareness in this model. And if awareness has some reality, then everything that appears within it that's made out of that also would have some reality. Gotta be careful with this word reality. But reality here, not as a, maybe don't take it as a philosophical context, what is real for us? Like when we say, are you aware, and we can at some point come to be 100% sure that we are aware, 100%. We might be dreaming, we might be hallucinating, we might be artificial intelligence. But, so I don't know about, you know, how the movie exactly operates. We might be seeing images on the retina. We might be, this might be, you know, a bunch of atoms operating, all kinds of stories. But what we do know is that there's experiencing of it, don't we? So in a way, when we use the word reality, we could say, like, if we're going to use the word for reality for anything, how about using it for something where we can 100% say there's not the slightest doubt that awareness is present right now. And if there's a little bit of doubt, you could say, what's aware of that doubt? And is there any doubt that that awareness is present? Okay, enough of this. Thanks for your patience and your questions. It's great to explore this kind of thing. And we can move through a lot of this Dogen tomorrow, because it's a long story is coming up. Okay?
Yes.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.